Well, we talked last time about the article and the adjective. And it's very important to, you just can't overemphasize the importance of that lesson, because it has so much application in the lessons that follow. The distinction between the attributive position and the predicate position of the adjective. And so I thought that what I'd do, and especially I'm going to do this since you two were here last time, we don't have anybody that wasn't, I'm going to kind of scan on ahead. Now, like on lesson 7, you have nouns, but I'm not going to give any attention to that. It's called masculine nouns of the first declension. Although probably most of the nouns in the first declension are feminine, there are some that are masculine. And so that's what this is talking about. And they're a little bit unusual. Nouns of the first declension ending in eta sigma are masculine. And so it gives the declension of that. But we won't take the time to deal with that. Nor will we take the time to deal with prepositions. Instead, we'll go on to lesson 8. And I want to show you some things about the pronoun autos. You have autos, which is defined here as he, but it would be he, she, or it. Depending on the conjugation, you'd have autos, aute, auton, or auta. So we'll look at that in a minute. And then ego, I. I'm not going to give any attention to the pronoun I. So I'm going to look at a me. I want to look at that autos and the way it is used. But I will say that in Greek, the only time you use a pronoun like I or you is in emphasis. Otherwise, the verb itself contains the information about who the speaker is. So the only time you would have that would be in emphasis, and almost always that is because of contrast. The emphasis will be connected with contrast. You say so-and-so, but I say so-and-so. That's when you'd have the pronoun in addition to the verb. All right, now on page 47, or paragraph 96, is where he talks about autos. And if you look at the conjugation, not conjugation, if you look at the declension of it, you will see that once again, if you know your endings to your first declension and second declension nouns, then you pretty well know the endings. That's the reason why, if you're studying this regularly, you really get those first down. If you don't get those first things down, then you just can't go on. But if you get that down, you are at least seeing that you wouldn't have to keep adding and keep adding. It's using the same endings. So that helps an awful lot. You will notice that because of the nature of this word, you don't have a vocative. You just wouldn't have a vocative, so it doesn't give you a vocative form. And so you have autos, autu, auto, auton, aute, autes, aute, autain, auta, autu, auto, auta. The thing that's a little bit different about the pronoun, for example, compared to the adjective, is that the neuter nominative of the adjective would be like agathon, just like a neuter noun would be. But the pronoun leaves the nu off, so it's auta. Now, hasn't one or both of you studied German a little bit? Okay. Do you remember, you know that in German the word auto would be pronounced auto, or auto. Now imagine you've just come off Greek, where that would be auta, and you're in the German class, and suddenly you got to say that word.
Right.
And auta, auto. And so I kind of stumbled a little bit doing it. My professor wondered, you know, what is wrong with this American? I mean, you can't even say a simple word like that. But that was why I had a problem with it. and I didn't, you know, I didn't say, oh, so that's because I've been studying Greek. You know, just couldn't do that. So I had to let him think I was a nut. That I'm slow. But anyway, that's the singular. And then the plural is the autoi, auton, autois, autus, autai, auton, autais, autas, auta, auton, autois, auta. And in this word, since it is accented on the penult, then in the genitive and the dative, in both numbers, you have the circumflex. All right. Now then, the use of this word, now particularly, it gives some general information about pronouns there. A pronoun is a word that stands instead of a noun. The noun for which the pronoun stands is called its antecedent. And the pronoun agrees with its antecedent in gender and number. And that's valuable for exegesis. When you're studying a passage and everything, that's a handy thing to remember. So, alright, let's see. Now we're going to skip on over.
I don't know if this would be the right place to ask this question, but so in English we have a kind of rough rule that the antecedent's always the closest possible one looking back. But is that really true in Greek?
It's not. Sometimes, I'd say probably more often than not it is. But by no means is that a rule that you can just use.
In English, more often than not, but certainly not.
Yeah.
Rule.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right. All right. Now, let me see. In this one, it deals a lot with the pronouns, but not the autos. Yes. All right. Let me make sure. All right, look on page, it's a very long paragraph. It's 97, paragraph 97. But look on until you come to parenthesis 4. And then under parenthesis 4, you have C. Autos is almost never used as a personal pronoun in the nominative case. In other words, you would almost never use autos to say, he is doing so-and-so. Like you would say, autos blepe, to make the point. He is seeing, that's what he means here. You just never use autos like that. And the place of it in the nominative is taken usually by certain other words, and it itself has in the nominative case a use distinct from its use as a personal pronoun. So that's what I want to look at. Now over in lesson 9, this is the demonstrative pronoun. And so here we're going to be going back to the information I gave to you about the attributive and the predicate use of the adjective, or not use, position. The attributive, and I guess it'd be all right to say the use, but it's also a position. And in the connection with these pronouns, it'd be better to say a position. All right, so you have two pronouns here to note. In paragraph 101, ekenos, which would be the pronoun for that in the singular, and those in the plural. So if you wanted to say that lamp, you'd say ekenos. Or those lamps, ekenoi. Alright, then the other one is the houtos. You see that? Houtos, haute, tuta. Houtos is the masculine, haute is the feminine, tuta is the neuter. And once again, you can see in the declension that it has there that the endings, you don't have to learn anything new. You pretty well got that down. Just in the masculine, you've got houtos in the masculine, the nominative masculine singular, haute in the nominative feminine singular. And in other words, I'm looking for the only ones that don't have a T in front of it. So there are only four forms that don't have a T in front of it. So it's not hard. And the main thing is just remember, like he's explaining there, the puzzling variations between U and Ao in the first syllable of this word may be fixed in the memory if it be observed that an O vowel in the diphthong U stands in the first syllable, where an O vowel, or the long of it, stands in the second syllable, and an A vowel in the diphthong Ao stands in the first syllable, where an A vowel, A, or the closely related vowel A, stands in the second syllable. So all that means is, if you have an omicron in the first syllable, you're going to have an omicron in the second one. And if you have an alpha in the first syllable, you're either going to have an alpha or an eta in the second syllable. So that means that it's not hard to remember that. And see, one of the things in studying this, unless you have thoroughly learned what that first part was, right now it seems like everything is something to be learned. But you see, if you learned it incrementally, by the time you get here, you wouldn't have much to learn. So it'd be a lot easier. All right, so and then the declension of ekenos is like the declension of adjectives in os, aon, like agathos, except that ekena stands instead of ekenon. Now, see, that's just what I explained to you about autos, that the only difference there between the adjective is that in the neuter, it does not have the nu on the end of it. It's just auta. Well, here it would be, and you can see it's in the hutus, it'd be tuta instead of tuton. And in ekenus, it'd be ekena instead of ekenon in the neuter. So, not much difference there. Now, on the use of hutus and ekenus, when they are used with nouns, now they can be used substantively. So you could just say hutus blepe, which would be this man is seeing. Now that would be one of those words that would be used in the nominative instead of autos. This man is seeing, or that man is seeing, or that man. So substantively they would be used. But this, look at the forms here under the examples. When they are so used, the noun with which they are used has the article and they themselves stand in the predicate, not in the attributive position. So this word, hutus halagos, which is a little strange to us because we would probably tend to say this the word. Well, in the predicate form, you'd be saying this is the word, if you were using an adjective. But this is not an adjective. It is a pronoun. So, this word is hutus halagos, or halagos hutus. So, you have to kind of make the little trick in your mind at first. This the word is so-and-so, not this is the word. That's just the way it is. Hutus halagos. Halagos hutus. In either case, the article does not precede the pronoun. That's the predicate position. That word, ekenos halagos, or halagos ekenos. I see this church, blepo tautain, tain ekklesian, or tain ekklesian tautain. Do you follow what I'm saying? These words, now we're using just the plural, that's the only thing. Hutoi, hoi, lagoi, or hoi, lagoi, hutoi. Those words, ekenoi, hoi, lagoi, or hoi, lagoi, ekenoi. Now, if you're anything like me, you'll find when you have a whole bunch of oi's strung together, it's kind of hard to say. Mm-hmm. Tongue twister. Mm-hmm. This good word, hutus, hakalas, lagos. Now, the thing is, there you're also putting in an adjective. You're throwing in an adjective. He's demonstrating. You throw in the adjective. In that case, In that situation, the pronoun, again, the pronoun does not have the article. So you have the pronoun starting out, then you have the article, then you have the adjective, and then you have the noun. Or the reverse, hakalos logos houtos. But the thing that's common to both those last two examples is that the pronoun is not preceded by the article. Okay? And then the point I made, houtos and nakenos are frequently used by themselves, substantively. All right, now, coming to the word autos, in addition to its use as a personal pronoun of the third person, autos is also used as follows. It has an intensive use with nouns. When so used, it stands in the predicate position. Now that's basically the same position that houtos and akenos stands in when they're used. Alright, so you've got the first example, autos ha apostolos. Now this is intensive. That would mean the apostle himself. So this would be a kind of an idiomatic thing that you would not have guessed. You could not have intuitively just guessed. So this is an idiomatic thing. Autos ha apostolos. This is the way you would say the apostle himself. And you could put that either way with the autos following. But in either one, it does not have the article. And remember that in the lesson on the adjective, it made the point that if you don't have an article, then you can't tell. You have to have the article to tell whether it's in the attributive or the predicate position. So if you have this intensive use, then you're going to have it. I believe that there are cases where you don't have it. And you just kind of have to use context to figure that out. So that's the intensive use. Now it has another use which uses the other position, the attributive position. And that is like if you have the article, the adjective, and then the noun, like the good man. But in this case, this is not an adjective. It is a pronoun, but it's in that same position. You have the article, the pronoun, and the noun. So, look at the examples there. Ha autos apostolos, or ha apostolos ha autos. Now, I believe that most people would find it simpler, more Englishy, to take ha autos apostolos, the same apostle, because there you can say you got your ha, the autos, same, and apostolos, apostle, the same apostle. But it is equally true of saying ha apostolos, ha autos. That still means the same apostle. And that one doesn't make sense as readily as the other one does because it seems so different from what we do in English. In its intensive use, it often goes with pronouns or with the unexpressed subject of a verb. All right, now this illustrates, now the example, autos ego lego. Now you see, in the first one, you're using the actual pronoun for I, ego. And so you could say, I myself am saying. Or you could just say, autos lego, without the ego. So Trevor, do you see what he's pointing out there?
So is one even more emphasized than the other?
Well, since by the very nature of it, to use the ego is intensive, then I would say yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So it would be more. So you've got that variety there. One thing in nearly, I think this is true in all language, that we want varieties of ways to say the same thing. And it is certainly true in Greek. It's true in Hebrew too. Very true. All right, now look at this chart on page 54. You've got all kinds of examples in that rest of that paragraph. But then in 106, paragraph 106, you've got a summary of the adjectives and of the pronouns. So let's just take a moment and look down through that. That'd be a that little chart there is excellent. All right, you have the good word, which would be the attributive position of the adjective. Ha kalos logos, the good word, or ha logos ha kalos. The word is good, kalos halagos, or halagos kalos. Noting again that in the attributive position, the adjective has the article before it. In the predicate position, it does not. All right, now he skips from those two examples using the adjective to the pronoun. This word, houtos halagos, or halagos houtos, this word. That word, just a different pronoun. Position is the same. Ekenas halagos, halagos ekenas. And then he demonstrates autos with its two different usages. The word itself, autos halagos, or halagos autos, the word itself. And then the same word using the attributive position, ha autos logos, or halagos ha autos. It'd be like the same word or the word the same. The word the same one. And then you've got my word, halagos mu, which I just haven't done anything like that. Now, his word shows how you often would use autos as like his word in the genitive there, the halagos autu. The word of him. And by the way, let me just tell you something else. I don't know if you fellows have ever been involved in the big debate and the big discussion about using Christian as an adjective. You ever heard anything about that? Well, in years gone by, it's been a sometimes a hot topic that Christian is never used in the New Testament as an adjective. Well, the thing is, in the New Testament, like if you were going to be talking about a Christian home, mm-hmm. It's true you wouldn't say ha Christianos oikos. But if you said the home of a Christian, using it in the sense a home characterized by a Christian, it had exactly the same sense.
So are you saying that the genitive in that case does not indicate possession? It indicates...
That sometimes, can indicate possession, but it can be used to mean the home consisting of, mm-hmm. or having to do with. So I'm just saying that when you do know this kind of thing, the debate about whether a word is used as an adjective or simply as a noun, that's not a valid mm-hmm. distinction to make, because so often, just like there, the word of me, the word of him, well, here it is possession. But it can be constructed in such a way that that's the way you would also describe, like the man of God. The man of God is a godly man. So whether you say godly man or a man of God, it's the same thing. So I'm really glad there's not that kind of debate going on, because there's enough to debate about and to differ about, not to have to do that kind of thing.
Now, how do you know, say, with the man of God construct, how do you know when it's indicating possession versus characterization?
I think that the context would have to... There's not just an overt rule that you could just apply. I think the context would have to let you know.
Okay.
And usually the context will pretty well settle it if this is just talking about his house or if it's talking about something that belongs to this person and therefore has characteristics. Sometimes if it were of a characteristic, then you could say, okay, then it's saying this thing is that kind of a thing. So that's what you'd have to do.
Let me ask a dumb question on that.
Okay.
Does that come into play any in the, you talk about the Son of God? Or like God's Son?
All right. Now, in that case, I believe that a Son of God or God's Son would mean precisely the same thing. Now, there, I don't think it would be, it would not be looking at a quality. Now, I think it is a legitimate point to make. And I think that point, in fact, I believe that the expression Son of God as applied to Jesus is making the point that he does share the nature of God.
Right.
But it's not equivalent to saying a man of God, meaning a godly man. It is rather saying that he is a son of God, therefore, the Son of God, therefore he shares the character of that Father.
But if you were going to say, I have a godly son,
yeah,
you would construct it the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. I doubt if they'd ever do it that way because of the tendency to confuse the idea.
I think they wouldn't even get close to it. Mm-hmm.
Because to avoid that confusion. All right. Now then, let's see. Let's look on over. All right. Now, I want to do this. We've looked at the verbs. We've looked at the present active indicative. Present tense, active voice, indicative mood. Now, in lesson 10, you have the present, middle, and passive. And so you're dealing with grammatical terms here that we really don't have in English, like the middle. We don't have a middle voice. And so you would never even think about this being the middle voice unless you had studied that in some other language. But of course we have equivalent things. The middle voice is defined as that in which the subject is acting upon or in behalf of himself. But the tendency would be to say, okay, so he buffeted himself. And so you tend to think, or he washed himself. You tend to get the idea that you'd use himself every time, but it's not that simple. It is not that simple at all. And he makes that point, like look down at the bottom of page 57 or paragraph 109 in the first parenthesis number one. Rarely the middle has the force which a verb followed by a reflexive pronoun in the objective case has in English. Thus, luo means I wash, and luomai means I wash myself. So you see, and the interesting thing is, just before that, he says, the middle voice represents the subject as acting in some way that concerns itself or as acting upon something that belongs to itself. And then he tells us, but that doesn't mean that you just plan on using myself, himself, herself, and all that in your translation. That it's just, it won't work out that way. It's kind of funny to me that he explains it that way and then says, but you can't use myself, himself, herself, and all that stuff. Rarely, rarely. Usually the force of the middle is much more subtle. And sometimes it's impossible to make any difference in an English translation between the active and the middle. And he says in some verbs, the difference in meaning is so great that the English translation will use a completely different word. Now, for example, arco means I rule, and archemai means I begin. And yet they are on the same stem. Now, one thing that is fascinating to me, but I don't have time to indulge it, is to study to establish the commonality between a word that can mean I rule and I begin. And I have no authoritative thing to say about it. I speculate saying that maybe it's the idea if you were there to start with, then you're the first and therefore you rule. I don't know whether that's a connection or not. But a lot of the words that you would see, there is no obvious connection between the meanings. So you're looking at a form here.
It's really just a vocabulary exercise. You just got to memorize and know.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And the middle of luo, now that's that particular verb, not other verbs. The middle of luo does not occur in the New Testament, but it is very important to learn it since it will enable the student to recognize the middle of other verbs. In other words, luo is your paradigm. It is your example. Because it is simple, it's a very regular verb, and it will furnish you with a model of most of the other regular verbs, even though it does not have the middle voice. In the present tense, we get a break. The middle and the passive are exactly alike in form. The context plus the word itself. As you get acquainted with the words, you would know which words would be used like this and which ones would not. But the form is exactly the same, and I'm not going to take the time because, see, obviously we can't learn these forms here in these short little surveys. But it's the thing is, you're not having to write Greek; you're learning to read Greek, so it's not going to be as important for you to be able to establish all the nuances in here. When you read it and you see a middle form, you will come to know there are certain words that are going to have a middle form, but they're going to have an active meaning. And we'll encounter that. It's called a deponent verb. But if it's not a deponent verb and you see it, then you will gradually develop the idea that even if you don't bring the himself or for himself, or you'll at least have that concept that that's involved here, that in some way the subject is acting in a way concerning himself, or he's acting upon a thing that concerns himself. And even if you don't bring that out in translation, you will at least be aware of that nuance as you deal with it. So let me see. Paragraph 113, he says, the present active indicative of luo can be translated either I loose or I am loosing. The passive of I loose in English is I am loosed. The passive of I am loosing is I am being loosed. Both I am loosed and I am being loosed might therefore have been given in the translation of the passive luomai. I am loosed. Now, can you make that little switch in your mind?
But the chronology is different, though, right?
I am loosed. What would that, what in English, what would that come across as saying?
That sounds like it either just happened, but it's a past event. Mm-hmm. Like maybe just happened.
But as a result, mm-hmm. I am loosed.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's your current condition.
Yeah, that's right. So what he's doing here is showing you that I am loosed is so ambiguous that the student is advised, at least in the earlier lessons, to adapt the alternative translation. I am loosed may mean I am now in a loosed condition, in which case it indicates a present state resulting upon a past action and would be translated not by the present tense, but by the perfect tense in Greek. So what you were seeing right there is the idea of the perfect tense in Greek. It's the present situation resulting on something that has happened already. And the perfect tense is one that takes a lot of reading and studying. There's a lot of variety in the way the perfect tense is used. But that's the basic idea. And so that's the reason why he is saying we continue to distinguish it, like I am being loosed rather than I am loosed.
Now, is that the reason or a similar reason to why you were usually so good. So if we, if you were asking, okay, what does blepe mean? And one of us might say, I see, you'd say, yes, I see, or I am seeing. Mm-hmm. Is the meaning of the, what is it, active, indicative, is the meaning typically more of a progressive?
No, I just wanted to keep the dual possibility okay. before you.
Okay.
That it could mean I see even a punctiliar idea. Mm-hmm. But he also says that that there is more of a presumption of an ongoing thing. But again, context will let you know, is this, you can tell. Sure. Like if I said, you know, like if I were standing here and you were sitting there and I was standing there and I said, I see cars going by. What would you think my see there is an ongoing thing or would it be a punctiliar thing?
Ongoing.
Why? Because cars. And it takes time for one and then another one. And I see a bird. Well, I see a bird.
I see what you're saying.
And so there might be a, you know, you might use it in a punctiliar sense or one where you're not making any particular point about it going on. But it can mean both. So that's the reason why I did that.
Okay.
Just to keep that before you. All right. Sozomai, I am being saved, represents the time is taking place at the present time. Could also be translated, I am saved, in such a sentence as, every day I am saved from some new trouble. Here, I am saved is present because it indicates customary action. But he's making again the point that this would be the idea more involved in the perfect tense. So, it's really not all that hard. He's just making the point that when you think about translating a passive, be careful that you don't give it what in Greek would be a perfect idea in your translation. You'd be translating actually a perfect tense in Greek when you're trying to translate a present passive.
So would you recommend the inserting the being?
Yes. That's what he says here. In the early stages, do that, and then later on when you everybody knows, you know, we all know that we don't have to make that point, then we could say I am being loosed. Or, I mean, I am loosed. But in the early stages, it's important to make that distinction between the perfect and the present passive, just in translation.
So what about our translations? Do they?
I was going to bring up an example. Added the church daily those who were being saved. Of course, this is a past instead of a present, but would that be a past passive?
All right, you're saying the were being saved?
Yes.
Now I haven't looked that up, but I would almost guarantee you that that's a participle.
Mm.
And that's another thing that I'm wanting to get to, not tonight, but I'm hoping that we'll be ready to get to the participle in that last lesson next week. But almost certainly that is a participle. I haven't looked it up to know for sure, but I believe almost certainly that will be a participle. All right. Now, in one thing to remember about prepositions, he's dealing with several prepositions here. Prepositions in Greek may have, probably I could say most of them have, more than one case they're used with. There are relatively few. I can think of one right offhand that would be... let me see. Yeah, maybe now ik meaning out of or from. I believe that's always used with a genitive. Soon meaning with is always used with a dative. But a lot of them are used with different cases, like dia. One is if it's in the genitive, like dia. whatever in the genitive, it'd be through. If it is the accusative, it would be by means of. And he uses hupa here, hupa with the genitive. The agent by which an action is performed. And let me look back here just a moment. And it lists back in the vocabulary, hupa, preposition with the genitive, by, expressing agent, but with the accusative, under. And thus we get the word hypo, hypodermic, beneath the skin, under the skin. So this is the word that we get hypo, hupo, hupa from. All right, now this, while we're here, notice this idea of the dative of means. Now this is one that is an important one. You've got several words, you've got dia, that could be used in the sense of this is accomplished through something. All right, that's expressing the idea of means. You've got hupa with a genitive that could express the idea of this is being done by something, an agent. But you may not have a preposition at all. You may have the dative of means. In other words, just the dative is sometimes used in the sense of by someone or something. As he shows here, egerentai to lago to kriu. They are being raised up by means of the word of the Lord. So in that Greek sentence, egerentai, and then you don't have a pupa, you don't have a dia, you just have to lago. So that is a very important thing to remember in your reading. In your reading of Greek, you want to remember that that dative case is sometimes used without any preposition to mean the means or the instrument by which something is done. And then that deponent verb section. The deponent verb just means a verb that, though it has one form, its meaning is that of another. And here he says, it has many verbs have no active forms, but only middle or passive forms with active meaning. Example he uses is paruamai. Now, if you can remember, luamai is the paradigm for the present middle or passive. So paruamai is that middle form. But it doesn't have a middle meaning. It's just the form, but it has an active meaning. It means I go. And you would not say, I go for myself or something. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means I go. It's just that form. I go or I am going. Now, you have compound verbs, which are merely the fact that we have these in English also. But it's when a preposition is prefixed to the verb. This is quite common in Greek. But we do that in English also. All right, now look at paragraph 119. Various cases with verbs. Now, one of the most well-known examples of this right here is in Acts 9 and Acts 22, where in Acts 9, the men heard the voice, but they did not see Jesus. Whereas in Acts 22, it says they heard not the voice. Big contradiction. Except it's not a contradiction at all. Because when you're using the verb akuo, and you notice how he uses akuo right there. Akuo, tes phonēs, I hear the voice. And when you're using the genitive, it has the sense of I hear the sound of it. But when it uses the accusative, it means to hear it with understanding. So in Acts 9, it's saying they heard the voice as it were a mumble, but they could not comprehend it. So they heard it. But now Acts 22 is using the accusative case, which means to hear with understanding. So they didn't hear the voice. See, meaning they did not hear with understanding.
Well, why don't we have that in the translation? It seems to me that that would be a legitimate, an expansion, I guess, of one Greek word some more English words tell you what's going on there.
And it really ought to be, because it leaves the wrong impression. You could at least put a parenthesis, something, you know. But that's right. But now, that's that illustrates the akouo. And he doesn't even tell all about it right here. He says, but akouo may also take the accusative.
Mm-hmm.
He does say that. But he doesn't give any examples of it or anything like that. But I don't know. There's still not a perfect translation, I guess. I like, to me, another example of where I think a translation would have been wonderful, and I have no clue why they didn't do it, is where Esau is saying to Jacob, I have enough. And Jacob says, I have enough. And most translations use enough for both of them. And they're using completely different words. Esau is using a word that means I have lots. I have a multitude. Jacob is using a word that means I have everything. And it, to me, is so significant, because it's not that Jacob's trying to outdo him and one-up him, but it's the point that Esau, coming to this meeting, had not had any idea that, you know, that my life is in danger. He wasn't worried about that. Jacob had been worried about the loss of himself, his property, his life, and everything. And now to have met Esau and to have lost nothing and to have his life, he says, I have it all. So it wasn't a matter of bragging. He was just saying to Esau, I feel like I've just got everything. And to me, that's very significant.
Yeah.
It's not brought out in a translation. I don't know why.
Hmm.
You think it's just being really conservative not to put any more words in there? Than...
I don't know.
Because it would be easy. It would be easy for us to look at that and say, you know, I have enough. Well, I have it all.
Mm-hmm. And it may be that they thought that it'd give the wrong impression or something. I don't know. I really don't know why.
You know, the other case that you were mentioning, we do that in the English some.
Like, oh, yeah.
You know, if Martha's calling to me from the other side of the house,
yes.
And I say, well, I didn't hear you.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, I heard her voice, but I mean, but the context implies that I didn't understand what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I've made the point when I've been teaching about that, about Acts 9 and Acts 22. I've used the example of some men out quail hunting in a big, big cornfield. And so they're going down the fence rows on either side. And so you have two or three of them over here and two or three of them over here, and the guys over there yell. And so you ask your buddy, you hear that? Yeah. What did he say? I don't know. I heard it, but I didn't hear it.
Right.
So...
the old proclamations, hear ye, hear ye.
Yeah, yeah.
Is understand this.
Yeah. That's right. Pay attention. All right, now, the next lesson, the next several lessons, is dealing with different tenses and so on. You got the imperfect active indicative, and you have the imperfect middle and passive indicative, and then you have the future active and middle. So the imperfect is ongoing action in the past. Now that is significant, like in John 1, verse 1, in the beginning was the Word. Imperfect. The was there is imperfect. And
so it means it started and ended.
It was going and it just kept going.
Okay, so starting in the past.
It was always going. It was just going. It was just going.
So there's no start beginning implied.
No beginning implied there.
Hmm.
Because in the beginning, not the Word began, but in the beginning, the Word was. Meaning that whatever the Word, whatever its nature, it went before the beginning. At the time of the beginning, it was. Already was. and had always was. And he gives the imperfect indicative of a mid in this lesson. And so in paragraph 133, you see the ain, which is third person singular, which is there in John 1:1. In the beginning was ain. In arche ain halagos. In beginning, ain was halagos, the word. So, the thing to remember here is the imperfect is the ongoing tense in the past. And even though we distinguish between that kind of thing in English, they distinguish it much more and much more accurately in Greek. And then you have the imperfect middle and passive, which would say the same thing about it that we did about the present middle and passive. And then lesson 13 is the future active. Now you'll notice that in the future, he has the future active and middle. Notice not the passive. The reason is because the passive in the future is significantly different. So that's reserved in form. It's different in form. So it's reserved for a future lesson. He's real careful about not overloading our memory, so he doesn't want to introduce a kind of a radically different form here. So he saves that until a good bit later. And it's fairly rare to have a future passive anyhow. You know, if you think about it, it's fairly rare. Now here's another thing. You know that word deponent? That deponent verb we were talking about in paragraph 164. Some verbs are deponent in one tense, but not in another. So bino has a future of the middle form, basemai. It is thus deponent in the future, but not in the present. So you see, bino is the present. And so you could talk about going. But in the future, you would use the middle form, basemai. So it's just a thing to do here is don't try to remember it, just note it.
So what does that mean in English?
Or it means to go. And so it would mean I will go, basemai. It would just mean I will go. So you see, if you were using that in the present, you could just say, bino, I am going. But now you want to say, I will go. Well, then you'd have to say, basemai. And if you looked at the future, all right, just take a moment and look at the future. The basic way that the future is made in the on the present stem, like lu, is you put a sigma on it. Instead of luo, it's luso. All right, now try to do that with bino. Binso, you can tell that's probably not going to be a winner. So in the future, you wouldn't have a binso. What you'd do there is you'd use basemai.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah, makes sense to me. Alright, the next lesson is on the aorist, and you've got several lessons dealing with the aorist. You've got a first aorist and a second aorist, and the difference is just in the way they're formed. The meaning is the same. It's
first declension, second declension.
Yeah, it's just a different way of declining it. So in your verbs, the aorist is, for the rule, you can say punctiliar. And that's distinguishing between the imperfect ongoing sense of the past and the aorist, a one-time thing in the past. Now the aorist, again, that's for your learning purposes. Actually, when you start studying the aorist comes nearer having the idea of without limit or without any particular limitations being placed. It's like, I'm not meaning to make any special point about tense here. Or something like that. It's a more subtle thing. However, I would say that a great many of the verbs, if they're an aorist, it is just that one-time thing back here. He just did it. No emphasis on anything. He just did it. We're not emphasizing that. We're merely stating the fact he did it. So, but that is the idea of the aorist. But aorist is composed of the alpha, which is called alpha privative. Alpha privative means that it's going to be like without. So take the idea of without. We're going to take away, and then the rest of it is from horizo, which is the word we get horizon from. So it'd be like ha, the ah, the alpha privative, without horizon. So that's actually what the word aorist means. But in terms of the indicative and so on, it means, as he explains in paragraph 168, it refers to past time, but the imperfect refers to continuous action. The aorist is the simple past tense. Punctiliar. But not just... Don't think. In other words, once you look at an aorist, don't assume that without any kind of exception, without any other possibility, this is emphasizing punctiliar. It may not be emphasizing punctiliar. There are other purposes that an aorist has. You can read in Burton on moods and tenses when he talks to you about aorist, and there are all kinds of. Sometimes an aorist may be used to express something that is It may be something that goes on for a while, but context would lead you to see that. So I'm faced with the idea of, you know, trying to give you the basic idea here without oversimplifying and letting you know that this doesn't just solve all the things to say aorist is simple punctiliar tense in the past. It's not that simple. But as a rule of thumb, you can use that. So we'll kind of leave it like that. And
so is there a past perfect then?
A past perfect.
Yeah. Don't we have past perfect in the English?
Yeah. And I believe that in Greek you'd be talking about a pluperfect tense. But I'd have to check on that to be sure. Because the past would be like he had done something or other. Present. Perfect would be he has done something. And I think that in Greek, you would have just your perfect tense would be kind of equivalent to our English present perfect. And probably the past perfect in English would be somewhat similar to the pluperfect in Greek. I think that's right. I believe that, let me just see here. Probably does.
While you're looking that up, the idea of perfect when you're talking in grammar. Number one, what exactly are we getting at when we use the term perfect? And what's the contrast when you say imperfect? And two, does it mean the same thing whether you're talking about Greek or English or any other language?
Yeah, Pruvol has the idea of the action. It's describing the action. Is it completed or is it not? And when was it? And when was it completed?
Okay.
And also, what are the consequences? Do the consequences continue, or were the consequences for a while, but they have stopped now? Mm-hmm. And just, you know, things like that. I'm just seeing if he has. Yeah, he's got a note here. Let me just check that.
So you're. Uh-huh. Your perfect usually has more of this idea that it's more than just a simple one-point event.
Yeah. Yeah, usually the idea is that it happened and the consequences have continued. The pluperfect tense is so rare that its forms need not be learned. It is a secondary tense. The pluperfect active forms a part of the perfect system, pluperfect middle and passive of the perfect middle system. We get a break. We get a break. Now, on the perfect tense, He says, there is no English tense corresponding to the Greek perfect. The translations I have loosed for lelouka, I have loosed for myself for lelomai, and I have been loosed for lelomai passive may often serve in the exercises, but they are makeshift at the best. It has already been observed that these same English expressions may often translate the aorist tense rather than the perfect. The Greek perfect tense denotes the present state resultant upon a past action. Mm-hmm. Suppose someone asks an official, what is your relation to that prisoner? And he replies, I have loosed him. The verb in this answer of the official would be lelouka. The perfect would express the present state of the official with reference to the prisoner, resultant upon his past action of releasing. But if, on the other hand, someone should ask an official, what is the history of your dealings with that prisoner? And he should answer, I have released the prisoner 3 times and imprisoned him again 3 times. The first verb of this answer of the official would be elousa. That's aorist. See, I loosed him. I loosed him. So, that's pretty interesting. Okay, well, we'll stop for tonight. And we'll be ready. The next lesson is on the third declension, and I'm not going to give any attention to that. But then we'll be ready to look at the participles. And I think that that will be a, kind of an eye-opener to you. And it is just so characteristic of the Greek language, the participle. I've read, and I don't remember if it's Machen, but he says, in the study of Greek syntax, the participle is quite the thing. Or something, some similar expression.
Yeah.
And it is. It is so very important. And what I'll try to do next time is I'll look up some examples in our common scriptures there, and I'll try to remember that when you mentioned. But we will look at that use of the participle the next time. And see, in using the participle, you're going to use that same attributive predicate idea in using parsive. That's why that lesson on the article and the